welcome to Better Done Than Perfect, a show for SaaS founders and product people. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and in this season, we talk about user onboarding with fellow founders and guest experts. Our guest today is the amazing AD Pienaar, the founder of WooCommerce and Conversio, which was later acquired and renamed into CM Commerce. And we're going to talk about his founder's experience with user onboarding across all his products. This show is brought to you by UserList, the best tool for sending onboarding emails and segmenting your SaaS users. To follow the best practices, download our free printable email planning worksheets at userlist.com/worksheets. Hi, AD. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
We're so excited. Give us a roundup of what your projects were throughout the years, what you're famous for, and what you're up for today at the moment, because you're not exactly employed right now, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first thing is, if you timestamp my journey into the kind of big buckets and ask me kind of what I'm famous for, like during my WooThemes and WooCommerce days, I left WooCommerce at the end of 2013 to kind of move on to new things. Back then, I was famous mostly for calling myself AD Rockstar. I was definitely not famous for like any insights into onboarding or thinking about it. I don't think that's something that was generally kind of your part of my mindset. So definitely that part of my life, AD Rockstar. And then in 2014, I started a new SaaS business, originally called Receiptful. We eventually rebranded that to Conversio. And what we did is we essentially helped e-commerce brands do profitable email marketing and had a greater kind of marketing automation kind of product there. And Conversio got acquired by Campaign Monitor or the Campaign Monitor Group a little bit more than a year ago. And I recently, as of kind of this recording at least, left Campaign Monitor a couple of weeks ago to start thinking about working on something new. Because I think what I learned was that beyond the fact that, for me, it's not even about not being employable. I think many entrepreneurs and founders speak about that notion that they can't be employed. For me, it was not that. I think what I learned in the last kind of year spending time with Campaign Monitor is that I really like getting my hands dirty in a way that I think one only does in a smaller team. And that's the kind of the part that I missed, being part of a smaller team, being able to do the work. So definitely keen to do that, and hence why I'm thinking about doing something new. In the meantime, though, I am spending a lot of time with founders, coaching other founders, doing some coaching within Dan Martel's SaaS Academy as well, where I'm a client and I've been a member for 3 years as well. And I'm also finishing up, putting the last kind of finishing touches, hopefully touch wood, ask my editor about it, but putting the finishing touches on my book called Life Profitability, The New Measure of Entrepreneurial Success, which is out in January 2021, if all goes well.
Is there a landing page for the book yet?
No, if I have the time to find someone to help me update my website, calling all ghost developers, then there will be a landing page there. But if anyone, like, that's the last kind of little punt that I will do. If anyone is keen on the book, my mailing list on my blog, which is ad.me, is probably the best place to follow. I also have, and I have started a podcast, which has 10 plus episodes where I'm interviewing loads of fascinating kind of people, not just entrepreneurs, but people that do things. And the podcast doesn't support the book. The podcast is also just called Life Profitability. So the mailing list and the weekly email is active. And if any of that kind of content resonates, the book will definitely resonate once it's out. So that's probably the best place for someone to kind of bookmark or subscribe for the moment.
Awesome. Now we've got all the bases covered for where can people find you. That's perfect. Now let's do a little bit of a deep dive into your business. And you've done a few. And that's amazing that you have this big time perspective that puts clarity on things. Like, you can really talk about your lessons and everything. So Conversio, tell us what the product does and what the audience is, and then we can dissect what you've been doing for years for onboarding and how it has progressed.
Yeah. So, by the way, it's interesting, just even answering that question, I think, is probably the hardest part of onboarding, right? But we'll get into that. So Conversio, as I mentioned, kind of our goal was to help e-commerce brands, normally kind of e-commerce brands that were built on WooCommerce, Shopify, BigCommerce, so any existing platform. And we would plug in and we would help them do profitable email marketing, automated profitable email marketing. So, and we had tools that were not just email related, a few other things that got into that kind of greater realm of marketing automation. But effectively, I said, kind of, I think the levers there are kind of marketing software that had an automation part of it and ultimately had to deliver revenue slash profit slash value to the e-commerce brands that we work with.
One thing that you mentioned, I couldn't agree more, is how you describe your product in and how it resonates in the mind of your customers. It's like 50% of a successful onboarding, isn't it? Is the expectation about the product. How has this evolved? What mistakes you made along the way, how you described it wrong, and what you think achieved the best result?
So yes, I think, you know, even in saying that, Jane, like we, and the way I describe, you know, Convergio, you know, which we call CM Commerce today, the way I describe it today is still mostly my words. And it's, I think it's part of that kind of learning and conversations with customers over time in terms of how, like what they want the software to be done, you know, kind of to do for them, right? And what kind of outcomes they want to get to. If I was process driven and formal enough, I would probably have read one of the jobs to be done books by now to fully kind of, you know, inform myself about the jobs to be done framework. But ultimately, I think that's what it comes down to, right? I think every kind of software product, you know, has to kind of, someone that signs up for it, they have jobs to do, or they have outcomes, desired outcomes that they need to kind of reach. And the software is merely there to kind of get them to that. And I think the onboarding there is, for me, very much about setting that initial context that is necessary for someone to feel this is going to, I think it needs to hit a few things. Like it needs to give them assurances that, you know, this is for me, right? This is kind of the product I signed up for. I am the ideal target here. But it also needs to get into those qualitative bits, which is to acknowledge that, you know, in any given space, there are probably multiple software solutions or solutions. It doesn't even have to just be software. It can probably get that person to the goal that they're hoped to get from your product. So I think in the onboarding, someone is already making an assessment about kind of the subjective part, which is like, is this experience, this, you know, UI, this UX, the customer support experience, like are all those things the things that I want from kind of something that I'm going to work with, right? So, and I think that's crucial to understand that both those bits, because without the latter, this is not just, I don't think it's just binary where we can deliver results. I think users are even business buyers. And, you know, part of why I kind of have stuck to kind of your B2B SaaS is generally because a business buyer is more predictable, more rational, like one can understand the logic in terms of the buying decision easier than say a consumer, right? Which kind of you have fashionable kind of trends that fluctuate and more subjectivity. But even in saying that, I think, you know, thinking through software, and that was something that we had to learn, was just because we think that we can do things in this way, right? Regardless of the outcome, some people might not like that way. And that might be the reason why someone never gets onboarded, never converts to a trial, never kind of, you know, stays or sticks with the product in the longer term.
I'm so happy that you're on the show today because your product has very, very big similarity to UserList. So I'm all eager to learn about the complications that you faced along the way, because the product Convergio as a product requires a lot of steps in order to actually deliver value, right? There's got to be some sort of integration. There's got to be some campaign planning, adopting the mindset, and then actually writing. How many steps that is? That's like enormous work. How did you struggle with helping people along that way?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, and I think the answer is back to simplicity and focus, right? Which is likely what we should have done. So the anecdote that I have here is when Convergio started, I mentioned when we started out, we were called Receiptful, and the original product had a much simpler kind of focus and hypothesis, which was we wanted to use email receipts, order confirmation emails that e-commerce brands were already sending their customers, and we wanted to help them kind of create a product that helped them interject marketing messages in that, right? So we had seen that the likes of Amazon were doing this, you know, include a coupon or include like other product recommendations. Like none of that was rocket science. We just wanted to help merchants and create the product for them to do so easily. And the reason I mentioned that is that was always the foundation of our company. And that's when we had the best kind of activation, the best trial conversion rates. Compare that to kind of, you know, and expand that over time. And as we started went wider with the product, what effectively happened is not only do we have more, like it's not about having more features and more tools or more things that initial users need to do, but you start attracting a much wider set of types of users in terms of what they are hoping to achieve with the product, right? Which means when you think about onboarding, it becomes really challenging to find someone where they're at today, right? And to really know, like, what is the thing that they're signing up to today, right? So is it to send an email newsletter, you know, in our case, or was it, I need to immediately, like, I am losing revenue through abandoned carts, and the one thing I need to get done today is to absolutely get a better kind of abandoned cart kind of, you know, campaign and strategy in place. And that became kind of much, much harder over time. So I said, I think like that was a big challenge for us. And I'm honestly not that clear about how to kind of just take my own advice here, which is to simplify and focus, right? But it is probably kind of as an abstract of that is truly finding and figuring out what kind of context that user brings, like within that first kind of, you know, that first moment that I sign up. Like, why are they there? What are the first things that I hope to achieve? And the onboarding almost needs to adapt to that, right? You can still try and activate them to all of the other things as well, but they're identifying the first three or four tasks, or if you want to use the Facebook seven friends aha moment analogy, right? Is like, what is that one thing that they want to achieve today, right? That gets them activated, that gets enough momentum going so that you actually have that engagement to, you know, not upsell them, but persuade them to use the other parts of the product as well.
This all sounds perfect as soon as you were doing this in theory. And then when you are actually trying to implement this in practice in running SaaS, then you run into problems. How do you figure out that intention in shapes of, I don't know, survey, self-segmentation, whatever, tracking or anything, to later messaging using that information? So what was your practical approach to that?
Yeah, so I think two things that really helped us, Jane. Initially, and again, like I think the first recommendation you'll see, I totally respect that in most software companies, engineering is always the scarcest resource, right? It's always the resource that's most overtaxed, and there's a place where we need to be most prudent about the things we build, right? Because ultimately, I know with engineering and with code, anything can be built. Like if you give it enough time and you give engineers enough time, anything can be built. That doesn't necessarily lead to kind of the best, you know, outcome, especially if you want to be cost efficient. So the two things that really work for us is, I think, you know, firstly, and even for me, when I would literally went through kind of a setup for, you know, a customer, right, and had to do certain things for them, like that's where you see kind of, oh, here we're lacking, here we're introducing too much friction. And like that's for someone that intimately knows the product, right? So you can imagine that all of those kind of, you know, gaps or points of friction is just kind of exponentially kind of worse on a user side if they see the product the first time. And I think the kind of the abstract kind of abstracted kind of framework for me there is always to think about, you know, before trying to systematize or productize or kind of automate anything, we need to know what those kind of different levers or steps are. And the only way to do that, in my opinion, is to kind of get humans to do that. So whether you're doing that yourself, whether you're doing it, you know, as part of your kind of, you know, customer success focused onboarding, whether you're just watching other users go through their process, I think early stages of onboarding needs to adapt to those learnings. And I think the only caveat there would be to, you know, to refocus down, to identify what your ideal customer avatar is, and exclusively focus on them, right? Just try and improve onboarding just for them, acknowledging that kind of other users might not have that direct benefit. So that was the one thing that worked for us kind of initially is to, and we went through a couple of those cycles where we incrementally changed and improved our onboarding. The other thing I think that kind of ultimately helped was we did some kind of, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call it segmentation, but we at least kind of had, and again, like we never got to the point where this was fully automated and you had this great native onboarding experience, but we at least asked a new user what their primary goals were, right? And I think we had, if I remember correctly, when we used this, there were about 8 goals that we kind of prompted them for. And we used, it wasn't like activate an abandoned cart, right? We kind of reworded the goal as a job, like almost kind of a job to be done or an outcome, right? Recover, like it could be recover lost revenue, right? So we identified those things. And then that at least helped us on our side. I said, we never got into that where we fully changed the onboarding to, depending on what you said there, it would be conditional. So next steps would be optimized for that. But we at least, again, like focused on our primary avatar there, said the bulk of our users said these are the main things that they need to do. And we structured our, I think, our initial kind of trial, kind of, you know, the nurture sequence or onboarding sequence in terms of emails and in-app messages around those kind of key things, right? And then, you know, kind of the prioritization there, again, that might have been off, right? That is not super personalized to someone. But we knew that kind of these and these things are probably easy, quick wins. And we knew, for example, in our onboarding that the biggest indicator of trial conversion was if someone had a conversion or when, i.e., if we touched kind of revenue or they got revenue resulting from their email marketing and conversion. So we would essentially prioritize the things that could get them there sooner, right? So timing and prioritization or ordering was probably off, but we could at least say, ideal customer, they need to do these 5 things. And I think we had 5 things that we still used in the last year, 5 primary things before we get you into the more of the kind of long tail of what you can do in the product.
What's your philosophy / approach to, once you have defined those 5 things, actually making, helping the customer do those things? Because there are so many other things that are happening in their life. How to make sure it's not forgotten, it's still on their to-do list at least, inform them, help them. What do you do?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the basics these days is that one needs a good communication framework, right? Across email, in-app, you know, if you want to add SMS, push notifications, like we never got into the latter two, but I think there's possibly, like if done well, like I would even consider those things. I think, like I said, those things these days are table stakes. I think what are important there is that one segments users properly, right? And make sure that they're event driven, right? So they're not just, it should not be, no onboarding kind of communication sequence should be a drip campaign of sorts. Like it should be like events and actually behavior based, right? So that you are at least kind of branching off, right? So I think that should be there. And I think that's also kind of keeping things top of mind, because oftentimes I do this, right? I sign up for a product, I get stuck into it for 10 minutes. I see that there's something interesting there, you know, there, and then I jump into, you know, a call with you and I kind of, you know, forget that I signed up for the thing that could have changed my life, right? So I think that's the kind of, that's the first part there to think about kind of that part. But then I think the other things and the things that work for us is kind of, you know, post-acquisition, we changed our onboarding to have a bit of a kind of gamification kind of, you know, aspect to it, which is mostly two parts. It's focused on a activation list, which was incentivized, i.e. you could get a longer trial if you did certain things, hence the gamification. We never played the gamification up too much, I think. I'm on the softer side of gamification in that sense, but that kind of, you know, helped. But having some kind of activation list helps. And we've had various kind of implementations of this. Back in the day when we were small, we even had a kind of getting started kind of just checklist, which we tried to personalize a little bit, right? But we could essentially tell you, and it would just be a checklist that someone could, that we could mark off if you did certain things. But we could tell you, for example, listen, we can see your average order value at the moment is $50, because we could tell that from your store. Do this thing to increase it, right? So the recommendation was generic. We managed to personalize the copy, and even that kind of helped us kind of get more activation on certain features. So think about activation. Think about having some kind of persistent list that you can refer someone back to. And then like we augmented that with kind of product tours within the app as well, so that they can kind of take someone through that. So I think those are important kind of things to have. But again, I think that gets into table stakes. My gut feel here, and this is something I'm passionate about, is I think in the last 10 years, we've taken, if we think about SaaS, we've taken software or capabilities at least that was only accessible to the enterprise. And we've truly democratized that, right? Meaning we've put great power into more people's hands at a price point that is actually affordable, right? The reality is that for most people, they're still not that sophisticated, right? They're not that sophisticated in terms of the thing they need to do, which means that there's this massive gap. And I don't think just UI and UX solves this, but just because I have the power and the capabilities in software does not solve for, I know I need to do this thing. I don't know how to do this thing or which next steps to take. So in onboarding, you can illuminate that kind of that next steps to take. I think the crucial part that is missing there is to say, what else can you do for the user that creates that initial momentum? Once they've kind of committed to, okay, this is the next step I need to take in the product, how can you make that job easier? And for us, it meant certain things which were all around having certain templates ready, having whole kind of automation kind of recipes ready, so that, because all of those things give someone a better starting point. But that's probably the thing that I would push on for kind of a product that gets some maturity. If you have some idea of like, this is where the friction points are, is doing more of the work for a customer. And if a user needs to take like 7 steps to accomplish something, can you take the first 5 steps for them? That's a harder part to solve, because that contradicts me in terms of, because that's a build kind of consideration, right? There's a lot of building that needs to be done for that to be effortless. But that's, I think, the part where kind of I think one takes a good onboarding to a great onboarding.
Have you ever employed special employees that would be customer success people and they would white glove the process, or has it always been sort of autopilot?
What we did and we still do is for higher value customers, like we would just do the work for them. But, and that makes sense when you're bootstrapping and like you're fighting for every deal, essentially. I think what that neglects is that doesn't, like, it's the typical kind of mantra or cliche of like, you know, teach a man to fish, give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day, teach a man to fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. I think with the white glove, like white glove solves the, you know, perhaps solves the trial conversion equation, but it does not solve onboarding, unfortunately. Like you do not onboard a customer by kind of doing the work for them. The onboarding is in, like, we need to show you how to do things in the software. We need to help you get to the outcome you want. So merely, as I said, and we did this, merely white gloving something and getting this set up gets us paid, but doesn't kind of, you know, in a year's time when we have 3 new features that we know can either kind of drive expansion revenue or retain that customer for longer, they do not have the skills to use the features that they had before that, right? Because we never onboarded and activated them properly initially, because we just did it for them. So I think white glove there is often kind of, you know, literally a kind of a plastering of cracks versus doing what it's supposed to be doing, which is settle and educate the, you know, your new user that you have in your product.
There are sometimes situations when you would like to instill certain insights into the mind of the customer. On the first stage, that could be explaining what the product does and if that's a good fit. It's more about like passing on the idea as opposed to like specific instructions. Then, I don't know, for us, sometimes we would really be willing to teach the person, please use behavior data to, let's skip on the messages instead of triggering them. It's one of the concepts that just needs to be instilled, and then it will help make life easier down the road. Were there things like that in your product? And if so, what did you do to communicate that insight? Like, because it's like, you can put it in writing, but it's not a guarantee that people will read it, right?
Yeah. So 2 ways, one carrot, one stick. I think, you know, in terms of like thinking through the things that we wanted customers to, you know, to do, we just pushed those things at them and said, listen, here's a big win for you. Here's a template ready to go, like add your logo, just activate it. Cause that plants the seed. And we could qualify that, right? So the good example in our case was, I mentioned how we started with email receipts. And one of the things that we actually innovated in the greater e-commerce kind of email marketing space was we would generate a unique discount coupon on the fly specific for each and every recipient of that email, which made tracking and attribution much easier. So as soon as you push someone to do that in the receipt, it's much easier to then kind of explain to them how to think about kind of using discounts in your email marketing and attribution afterwards, right? So, you know, a bit of a push initially and then almost back into the education and insight after that, when you also have the kind of the, you know, hopefully have some value to report there. So we did those kind of things, but then we also did kind of what I call the stick approach or just the kind of the limiting approach, which is for the longest time, and we eventually changed this, not for this reason, but for the longest time, we only allowed a user to send a maximum of 3 emails for every abandoned cart session. And we did that even though our competitors allowed you to send as many as you want. And we would often get users that said, you know, why don't you do this more? And we just kept saying, because it is our belief and opinion that if someone abandoned a cart and they've ignored 3 emails from you, you should stop sending them email. They probably do not want to buy from you or they do not want to buy this product, right? And I think that's not even an education thing. That's just a kind of being very kind of, this is where we draw the line in the sand. And if this is going to be make or break for you as a user, then so be it, right? So it's not like you either, your question was about education, right? If I think about my kids, if they go to school and they do not want to learn the things that they're being taught there, no teacher is going to teach them anything. Like if they've decided that this is not what they want, like, then that's off the table. And I think the same with onboarding. If someone truly wants something different, no amount of education within the product at that stage is going to change their opinion.
Sad but true.
Yeah. Which I think in like thinking through, I mean, you asked about kind of your learnings from onboarding, Jane. I think like when I work with founders these days, like, you know, and thinking through kind of where the challenges are in their product, the one thing that I often get to, because if they have a churn problem, right? So reworking from the back, if they have a churn problem, always try and identify like, where is that churn happening? Is it happening kind of, you know, ad hoc or ad random later in life, you know, life stages? Or is it happening in 60, 90 days? Or if it, you know, is it a trial conversion rate occurring a problem, right? Which is not necessarily churn, but you at least had a lead and they didn't convert their trial. And oftentimes what I, for example, find there is, If churn is worst in that kind of 60 to 90 day range, meaning they've converted their trial, they've started paying you and they churn after that, then it's actually not a product problem at all, in my opinion. Then it's actually a positioning and messaging problem, which means the user came to your product expecting something totally different. They got into the product and it just took them time to kind of connect those two or realize disconnect because they couldn't connect those two things, right? Which is all back to that kind of education. At that stage, like, I don't think education is a very reactive kind of step to try and take there because someone got there and wrong, not necessarily bad, but for the wrong reasons or with the wrong expectations. And most products, especially younger products, can never then kind of meet those needs or kind of meet those desires of the user because you can't be all things for everyone. Simple as that, right? So like that's the whole mouthful, but that's how I think about education. Education is unfortunately within the product is, you know, oftentimes way too reactive and probably too late. Like that person has probably already made up their mind and education itself is not going to save you.
A little bit on the technical side, as founders, we have limitless possibilities of tracking user success points within the app, different success metrics, product analytics, like as much software as you can buy for the analytics inside the product. Like how granular did you go in your product with that?
Probably not granular enough pre-acquisition, to be honest. Because I think these things, again, like I think the biggest, and we never looked, interesting enough, this is, most people should not hear this from a founder that is sold to companies, right? But for the longest time, Jane, we did not have proper user-based event tracking, right? So we didn't really know which parts of our product users used and kind of didn't use, right? And I think crucially in that kind of that first part, when we made the transition from kind of being receipts first, receiptful, and then focusing and kind of rebranding to conversion and building a wider product. We had a lot of momentum and a lot of revenue growth, but I think that's the first point where we skipped over like proper product market fit, right? Where we assumed certain things about what users were, the jobs we kind of, they were using us for versus kind of what they were actually doing, right? And what we were thus kind of building and optimizing for. So we should have probably had that. I think the key there is, and it's not like we didn't have any kind of data. I think the key thing there is that there needs to be segmentation in place, right? Because not all users are equal, right? So again, coming back to really an early stage product, really being focused on that very specific ideal customer avatar and optimizing everything kind of for them. So one of the things we did post acquisition is we got access to fancy new tools and we started using Amplitude, which was the first time that I kind of was using Amplitude. And I think crucially, and this is one of my biggest learnings within Campaign Monitor, was to think about kind of measurements. And I think what is key there, and probably where we failed initially in our own tracking, was not that we didn't try this, but if you do tracking in a kind of almost an ad hoc incremental basis, like i.e. as soon as you release a new feature, you have to add a new event, for example, we didn't have that encyclopedia or reference about what the events actually meant. So we would have Kissmetrics or a mixed panel, whatever. And suddenly there are events that all have the same names, but probably mean different things, right? So the first thing we did kind of post-acquisition was we at least had this kind of reference guide, this encyclopedia of saying, here's the events, here's all their kind of metadata kind of properties. And like, this is when they fire, because that's crucial, right? Because user sign up, like for us, could mean like different things. Like, was it immediately after someone like connected to their store, or when they actually went through our kind of 3 or 4 step kind of onboarding kind of process, right? And those two things like means different things. So I think having that kind of reference guide was important. And then the way we really used that analytics data was, and we changed the way we built the product, was to really think through, if we build this new feature, how are we going to measure like impact? And we defined kind of expected impact, right? And we kind of, before building, defined what success for that would actually look like. And then we made sure that we could identify the additional tracking we need to do, whether it's events tracking or something else, and how that would relate to our kind of, kind of higher level metrics, whether it was churn, whether it was expansion revenue, whatever that kind of a higher level kind of metric was. But it was only then in our tracking that we could start seeing like what impact did kind of the things we were doing in product, whether it was onboarding or not, actually had an effect on any of those other metrics, right? And that was helpful. So I would go granular, and I would do so earlier. Like if I built a new SaaS, like I would do so earlier as well. I would not wait kind of to be, for us in our case, 5+ years and be acquired to, before we put those things in place properly. I think having that historical data is beneficial, but I would also not kind of try and overtrack things, because like many of the kind of abstracted things, or there are nuanced kind of insights that I don't think just peer tracking and trying to visualize a single kind of funnel of like, here's the first step in a process a user takes to getting to them to this outcome. It's not that obvious.
Yeah, because sometimes we talk to founders and it seems like you wouldn't see the forest behind the trees, because they want to track just everything. And it's going to be very hard to understand the bigger picture because of this influx of smaller, tiny events like paid views or something they want to do.
Exactly right. Which is in our case, by the way, the tracking that we did have in place kind of throughout was always around at least understanding on a user level kind of like what our successful users were doing, right? So we knew that they were using this and that kind of feature. We didn't necessarily know how they were using that feature, at what kind of cadence they were using that kind of feature, or why they were using that feature. We also didn't understand kind of journeys or funnels necessarily. So it wasn't like we didn't have anything. And that's probably where I would start, right? Is like identifying like if kind of anyone building a product today, if they had those kind of 2 or 3 things in the product, defined things that a user needs to do, track those things and track, like add the interim steps to help you identify like for those users that are doing those things and not getting to that outcome versus not getting to that outcome, right? Because that's like, that's where you had need the granular data. Like if you're not going to try and optimize that thing, I need them to send this email or click that button, like then it doesn't help to track the kind of the interim steps. Then you can just track everything at a high level.
Thanks so much, AD. This is super helpful. And before we wrap up today's episode, just ultimate question, two tips for our listeners, one do and one don't when it comes to successful user onboarding in your SaaS product.
Yeah. Ooh. So I think the do, I'll stick to the think through that ideal customer avatar and truly think through kind of, you know, full funnel, right? From kind of how you message this to kind of what are those initial kind of, you know, things you want them to do during onboarding, and make sure that that kind of messaging is consistent throughout, because that's the very first part of, you know, personalizing that journey and giving them enough context, truly finding them kind of where they're at that stage. So, and as I said, like that onboarding starts by kind of from the moment they hit the website and kind of sees that kind of first kind of your product promise that you give them about your product. So that's definitely kind of the do there. And the don't is, it's probably don't build anything for your onboarding. Don't build some kind of fancy native, like slick, you know, process to, you know, help users do that thing until you've done so yourself manually countless times and truly understand, like, you know, what are the inputs involved? What are those other considerations involved? Like, what is that process involved? Because unless you understand the process manually, there's no way that you can build the automated process.
These are wonderful words. Thank you so much. I guess we already answered the questions, where can people find more of your work online? But feels like ad.me is the place to go, right?
Yeah, totally. And if anyone wants to boost my ego, always like follow me on Twitter at, I'm at just at ad. Like I measure happiness in terms of Twitter followers. So that is half a joke. Not entirely untrue, but yes, Twitter would be the other place in addition to my blog and newsletter.
Amazing. Thank you so much for amazing advice, and have a wonderful rest of your week.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jane.
Thanks for listening. If you found the episode useful, please spread the word about this new show on Twitter, mentioning UserList, or leave us a review on iTunes.